Hello, everybody. Jan Rutherford here with Self-Reliant Leadership. And I have a very special guest today, none other than General Stanley McChrystal. And for those of you that aren't familiar with his work, he is the author of My Share of the Task, Team of Teams, Leaders, Myth, and Reality. And he's got another great book coming out in October called Risk, A User's Guide. And Stan spent 34 years in the military, retired as a four-star general. 6 years of that was deployed in combat. He created the McChrystal Group about 10 years ago upon retirement. He's taught at Yale. He serves on the chair of, or on the board of JetBlue and some others, and has really helped a lot of leaders and executives and people in government over the past year deal with resilience and uncertainty and everything that's come with the pandemic. But today, what we really want to talk about is his advocacy for national service for 1 million young Americans. So with that, Stan, welcome. I'm so glad you're here with us talking about something that we're both passionate about.
Jen, I'm honored to be here and thanks for having me.
Yeah. Hey, we're mainly going to talk about this, but I want to just ask you one thing. As I reviewed your bio again, it's pretty long, and a lot to be proud of. I'm wondering, of all the things on there, you know, what are you most proud of?
You know, it's interesting. A few years ago, when I was doing an event for National Service, my wife Annie, of now 44 years, told me that if National Service becomes a success like we hope it does, this will be the thing in life that I will be most proud of. I don't think she's wrong. And so the idea that we can have an impact on an entire nation and generations that follow would be humbling. We're not there yet. But that, I think, would be the crowning thing I would be happy about.
Yeah. Well, you wrote an article in Time about some of the challenges we're facing as a nation and globally. And one of the things you said was the state of American democracy feels fragile. So what's, you know, as a former military officer, one of the things that you always did was, you know, what's the situation? You know, that's what you looked at first. So what's the situation?
Well, thanks for asking that, Jen. I start with the idea that America is a nation, and a nation that was not founded by papal decree. It was a bunch of people who came together and made a compact or a covenant between each other to form a place. And that place was going to require everybody to do things for the common good. And from that, they would derive certain advantages. They would get citizenship and they would get protection and they would be part of a vibrant economy. A nation only works if the citizenship in it works. If all of the people who are part of that feel like they're shareholders, they have a stake in the future. And what I would argue is in the United States, we've allowed the idea, the very concept of citizenship to erode or shrink in our minds. Most of us got our citizenship because we were born here. We didn't do anything for it. And so in some ways, I don't think we always value it. Also, many people think if they pay their taxes and they vote, and not enough of us do, that they've done their obligation for citizenship. But really the idea of citizenship is you're looking out for every other citizen. The Ranger Regiment, where I spent much of my career, used to have or still has a Ranger Creed, and in it is a line many people know: I'll never leave a fallen comrade to fall into the hands of the enemy. And what that is it's a promise to every other Ranger that no matter what happens, I'm here for you. And they've never violated it. And if you think of citizenship in the same way, I have an obligation to every other American in some way that I've got to do my part. Then you start to get in the idea of why America is in a difficult point right now. We'll always have political disagreements. That's the nature of democracy, and that's okay. But when we suddenly get up in the morning and we think of ourselves in small, fragmented sections of society or almost the tribal nature, or we think that it's a zero-sum game and the more I get and the less you get is good for me, bad for you, then I suddenly think we start to not have a working nation anymore. The very concept of it is fragile. And that's what concerns me now.
Yeah. Interesting. I was speaking with a client this morning who described a near-death experience that he had at 39 years old. And as he lay there thinking he was going to die, waiting for rescue, one of the things that occurred to him was, boy, I haven't given enough to my community. And since then, that's what he's done is give and give and give. And it's interesting that, you know, for him, he said that it took a near-death experience to figure that out. And that would have been a regret had he died, that he didn't give. So as you assess the situation on the ground, I mean, what are the options that we have before us, that, you know, the singles and the doubles and the triples, you know, when we look at that and we say, what would make the most impact? What's the easiest to implement? What are all those things that you looked at?
Well, let me tell you the option we're on right now, and that is to not do enough. And to have only about 25% of young people in the United States able to enlist in our military. 75% are not eligible for a variety of reasons, physical or educational or whatever. So only 25% can serve in the most traditional way in uniform. And we don't let the rest serve. And so we are, in my mind, on a road towards a decline. We are going to be less competitive in the world, less well-trained, less well-educated, less well-connected to each other. So if you start with the course of action of the status quo, I would say we've got to take that off the table. Doing nothing is not an option anymore. So what do you do? Well, you say, well, okay, we can teach people in civics class better about how America works and inspire them. And that's helpful. But the reality is most of us learn by experience. If you do things, even if it was unpleasant in the moment, there are many things that I've done. I walk away and go, you know, I was actually better for that. My years in the Army forced me to develop some habits and behaviors that are good for me now that I don't think I'd have done otherwise. So you start to say, how do we create an experience for young Americans that shapes them so for the rest of their lives they'll be better citizens? Well, you say, well, we'll draft everybody and put them in the military. Well, one, we don't need a military like that. Two, not everybody's right for the military. And so then you say, well, what do? We create opportunities for young people to serve society and serve in the way that they are maybe best suited or most interested to do. We have a number of programs now, AmeriCorps, VISTA, City Year, Teach for America, and they're all really good. But when you add them all together, they're really small numbers. We have 4 million young Americans in each year group. So each year group, 4 million Americans become 18, 19. And we believe that until you get to critical mass, and which we've said is about 25% of that year group doing national service, until you get to that, you don't get to the point where it's so common that every lunch table in school has a conversation about it. Every family has somebody doing it. So suddenly it becomes an expectation. You know, people say, well, why don't we make it mandatory, make everybody do it? And the reality is there are times when I fantasize and I say that really would be the best way. But yeah. So many Americans oppose mandatory, and if somebody chooses to do something, often they're more committed to it. And so what we'd like to do is make it voluntary, but expected, which means that young people, when they come out of high school, they've got a period, we'll call it 10 years from 18 to 28, who they should sometime in that period do a year of full-time service in one of these things: conservation, healthcare, education. And it's important that it be full time because it's got to be a commitment where you immerse yourself. It's not 2 hours every Saturday morning. You immerse yourself. It's also got to be an experience where you do something that you probably wouldn't have done. You work in an inner city school. You work in a national park. You take care of elderly Americans. You do something that gives you a new appreciation for the things that have to be done in America. And then the last part is you do it with people not from your zip code. not from your small tribal group, your economic background, your gender, your race. So the idea is we integrate young Americans with this very impactful experience in a time when they all walk away with it. And then think into the future, and two young Americans are on a train and they start a conversation with, well, where did you serve? And the response is, well, this is what I did. Or if a ambitious young person wants to run for Congress and they get up the gumption and they get out on the campaign trail and someone looks at them and says, okay, Susan, what national service did you do? And if they couldn't answer that question, voters would immediately say, well, why are they suddenly asking us to commit to them when they were unwilling to make a commitment to the nation? You know, the impact that it leaves on the person, it's not what they accomplish during the year. It's not how much work they get done. It's what we plant inside ourselves to change ourselves as citizens, to suddenly feel like we are responsible to our neighborhood, to our society.
And do you see this being more something that someone does after high school and sort of the gap year, or somebody that goes to Yale and could go to Goldman Sachs and decides, you know what, I'm not going to go make $150,000. I'm going to go do a year of service. Do you see all these people being together?
I do. And I see it being a combination. I see some people, it's right for them to take a gap year and they go off before college or before a job if they're not going to go to college, and they have that experience. It would have helped me a lot. You know, I stumbled quite a bit at West Point because I was a knucklehead showing up. And if I'd done something for a year, I'd have been a better cadet. I couldn't have been a worse one. But also, you know, a very talented person goes to Yale or goes to a very good university. It would be great if Goldman Sachs says, great, I want to hire you. And David Solomon goes, you know, I'd really like you to report 1 year from now, after you've finished a year of national service, because I think you will burnish this education you've gotten with life experience, and you will come to us as a better citizen, and we would value you more then. And we'll hold this position for you. Show up in a year.
Would be interesting, the possibilities. What I'm thinking through is someone might decide, you know what, I've learned some skills, I've done some work on the infrastructure, I want to go into the trades, and I've got a year. Someone else might go out there and they're not sure, and they get together with that person that was going to go to Goldman Sachs, and that person at Goldman Sachs all of a sudden has someone in their network, in their friendship circle they wouldn't have otherwise, and maybe they're able to pull them to a different station in life than they would otherwise. They're able to see some opportunities. When you and I spoke before, you talked about, boy, wouldn't it be great if everybody was reading sort of the same things, that there was a common vocabulary, that philosophically we looked at things and had these discussions. Do you think part of this, part of as they onboard and get welcomed into the program, and forgive the choice of words, but there's some sort of indoctrination, much like, you know, when you go in the military, there's a boot camp where everybody sort of gets broken down and then they get built up. Is there something like that that creates this bonding experience and common vocabulary?
In most of the programs now, there's an initial training, because the very well-run program, successful city year and AmeriCorps and whatnot, they've learned that they've got to make the experience very well organized and run and safe, and that initial training is important to that. I would argue that a common initial training, as you say, a boot camp equivalent would be very valuable. No matter where you're going off to serve, if you got some core principles, if you got taught a little bit of leadership, remind a little bit of values, taught a little bit more about civics, what we're trying to do, and given a picture of the big experience you will all share, that would be very helpful, because you want people, when they're doing their narrow task somewhere in the United States, you want them to feel that they are a part of a fabric, a larger effort, almost like the New Deal effort was. You know, that old story about a man walking down the road and he runs into two people cutting stone. And he asks the first person what they're doing, and the guy says, well, I'm cutting this stone. He looks at the other person. He says, what are you doing? And the guy's doing exactly the same thing. Says, I'm part of a team building a cathedral. Mm-hmm. The difference in mindset, I think, that we could plant in young Americans would be invaluable.
Yeah. You've said a resilient democracy requires fact-based thinking and public policy. I'm wondering if you're able to articulate, I mean, here's really the big strategic benefits to our country. And then, you know, here's what's in it for me. Here's what it's in it for me. Are we able to basically lay that out?
I think we can. We can make the large argument that someone who does national service votes at three times the rate of people who didn't. Mm. People who do national service have a tendency to serve for the rest of their lives as volunteers and different things. So they are, by data, they are better citizens, more participatory and more supportive. But also the experience, if you go back to veterans of the Peace Corps, veterans of AmeriCorps City Year, ask them the effect it's had on them after the experience, almost universally, they will say they are different people for it. They see the world differently. If you ask military veterans, even if the experience was at times distasteful or dangerous, they will usually come back and say, I think of myself differently, and I see the world differently. I saw young soldiers go to places like Afghanistan and Iraq, and from a distance, those people are different from us, different religion, different culture, not to be trusted. And when you get up close to them, of course, that's not the reality. Whenever you get up close, people are people, and you start to have a more nuanced view. And so our ability to give people wider context for things that they have not been exposed to in their narrower world is important, because democracy is based upon compromise, and it assumes a certain respect for the people who are fellow citizens who don't have your same political views. If you hold them in absolute disdain, it doesn't make for an effective democracy. It makes for a very fragile, winner-take-all, combative democracy, and that's not what our nation needs.
Yeah. You're making me think of a book I read last year called The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt. I don't know if you've read it, but it was about why we're so different in politics and religion. And my takeaway from it was, boy, we all start at the same place. Right. We just take a real different path and end up in different places. But, you know, what you're describing makes me think we would develop a more nuanced appreciation for the fact that we all do start in the same place. And maybe it would cause us to come together better and engage one another, have a broader point of view, more understanding and tolerance.
This may surprise some listeners, but in my years in Iraq, as we were fighting against Al-Qaeda in Iraq, obviously an incredibly difficult enemy, and in many cases, you know, they could arouse your passions. But the reality was the average Al-Qaeda member was a dedicated person who believed in their cause and was committed to a sense of team, not very different from the best people in my organization. The difference was the accident of what their life experience was that took them to that particular organization. Had I been through the same life experiences as many of those, I suspect I would have been in that group. And when you step back and you realize so much of that is accident, you step back and say, well, how do we give young Americans the best opportunity to end up in the right place? And that is to help them have experiences which get them in the right direction, put them in the right mindset. And so I think it's critical. We're having problems with people being ideologically brought to levels of extreme in our country right now, and even to violence that are absolutely abhorrent to most of us. Mm-hmm. But it's a series of life experiences that contribute to that.
We've got a comment here from Jesse Levine. How might we brand or otherwise package national service in a way that causes it to be an expected element of CSR? Wouldn't it be great if the investment houses request a year of service before taking on two new team members? Could we not convince one prestigious firm to trial in some way that leverage the pilot program to incentivize others?
Jesse, the answer is we can, and we have done that, but it hasn't been totally effective yet. We've gone to a number of firms and asked them to be firms associated with national service. We've asked universities to give preferential admission to people who completed a year of national service, big firms to give preferential hiring. Many have done sort of weak versions of this. If we would strengthen that, if we would say that if you apply to Yale, you and you're a national service veteran, you go into a different pile. Doesn't guarantee you get in, but you get different consideration. The same way with any big firm. I think that we absolutely should. I'm also a believer that things like community college are important for the nation, but I don't believe in free community college. I would believe in free community college after you finish national service, because then you've earned something and you don't feel like you got it for nothing. And the nation gets, it gets two benefits. It gets the year of service and the growth, and it helps educate you, which we want for the future. But I think a responsible society where people contribute to receive is really important.
Yeah. Now, the obstacles to make this happen. I mean, there's public policy, there's corporations, there's individual, there's money. What have you identified as the big obstacles that need to be overcome?
Sure. The first is inertia, Jim. And that is because we've been talking about this since the days of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, but we've never really gotten out of first or second gear. We've always had sort of low level, and they're great programs, but they're not big enough. The inertia is, I think, that our generation, the vast majority, didn't do it. So they don't sit at the dinner table and look at their kids and grandkids and say, where are you going to do it? And there's a little bit of guilt involved. You don't want to tell people to do something you didn't do. So that's part of it. I think there's inertia in universities and firms, because nobody wants to be the first firm that requires people to have it or gives big preference because it might disadvantage them. I do think we're seeing a shift in corporate mindsets, and hopefully in higher education, where they start to get a little bit more demanding and bold in this regard. Money's an issue. We did the math years ago, and for 1 million kids a year, that's about $23 billion. And that's money required to provide a stipend that they can live on, because you have to pay it, or it's limiting it to people whose families can support them. So you have to give people a living stipend, and there are other costs. So the calculation was about $23 billion. And that sounds just huge, but it doesn't sound huge compared to what we just put into the economy, you know, as part of the pandemic and the infrastructure. So the reality is, this is not a daunting bill. Now, we don't believe it ought to be a big national government program, you know, that we have the Secretary of National Service that lines everybody up. We think it should be a public-private partnership where there has to be public funding as a good percentage. There has to be very supportive public policy. That means law that supports it. And then there's got to be energetic private participation. So many of these groups would be locally run. Some would be faith-based. They would all be forced to adhere to certain standards so that someone participating, receiving the stipend and all, you know that they're actually doing, you know, a real program with effective work. But all of that's doable. All we have to do is make the decision that this is important for the future of the country.
Yeah. You know, I'm reminded when I was, you know, when I joined, I joined as a private, 17 years old, 2 weeks out of high school. And I remember what was beat into my head was task, condition, standard. You know, in other words, you know, here's the expectation. This is a task under these conditions to this standard of quality. And I find in my work as an executive coach and an advisor, that much of what I spend time doing is helping people understand that they haven't really outlined the expectations. They're disappointed that the team, the organization isn't performing But at the end, they end up looking in the mirror and saying, it wasn't clear. I mean, as you know, the commander's intent wasn't there. Do you think by doing this type of service that, you know, what corporations would gain and governmental agencies would be people that come into the work world that know how to have healthy disagreements, that know how to have conversations about where they stand as far as meeting the standard, and that they're able to convey that as future leaders?
I think absolutely. Now, it's not guaranteed because this is a hard task, but I would start with the first task is to produce better citizens. So this would be overt. You wouldn't hide it from anybody. When young people come in, you'd say, part of the goal is to affect you 20 years from now. And so we are going to try to plant things in you that will take time and they will grow. Be very straightforward about it. Responsibility of that. Then the second would be, there's a lot of young people who need to learn when to get up in the morning, where to be on time, how to do things, because we all go through that. In a structured environment where you are performing things for a larger entity, society, is a good, it's a good reminder. It's a good reminder for people who didn't have that as a young person or have never had a difficult job. That experience, as you learned, you probably got better for the experience, although you didn't enjoy every moment of it. I think we could all use a bit about that, and we shouldn't kid ourselves and pretend that we don't.
Yeah. You remind me of your friend, Admiral McRaven, you know, make your bed. If you don't get anything else right in the morning, make your bed. So we're coming up toward the end of our time. President Biden's action yesterday, Service Year Alliance praises President Biden's nominations for the board of directors of the Corporation for National Community Service. What are the next steps? In addition to, that sounds like a good first, a good initiative there. What other next steps are there?
The president is putting the foundation in place. The next step is to convince the American people. We can push for law, but as we know, our lawmakers respond to the will of the people. So what we really have to do is, with the help of people like you, leaders like you, Jim, we've got to create in American populace and opinion leaders the idea that, yes, we can do this, we should do this. And so that means we've got to create the idea that the belief that, of course, it's doable. There are a lot of people who will come to me and they'll go, yeah, it's a great idea, but we can't do that. And I say, why? And they go, well, you know, it's expensive. I said, of course we can do the money. So why can't we do it? And they'll go, well, you know, it's hard to make a million young people or more do something. And I said, when you incentivize them, you're not going to, the problem is not demand from young people. The problem is supply of positions. But we as Americans are sometimes intimidated by big objectives now, big goals. You know, I read a book not too long ago about the Hoover Dam, the construction of it. And at the end of the book, it was very depressing because the author says we couldn't build it now or anything equivalent because we couldn't get the six states to agree on the water rights and everything else. Mm-hmm. And so I think we've got to just step back and say, we are going to do it. Now we'll figure out how we're going to do it. So we've got to convince the American people. And then I believe that the political leaders, you know, with the help of people like President Biden, who lay the road in front of them, they will then push the necessary legislation and support.
Yeah. You know, we started talking about the fragility of the democracy. I can't help but think that, you know, we know there's a growing divide between rich and poor, that you know, from a system perspective, this would really bolster the middle class, you know, re-bolster the middle class, has the potential to do that, I think. Do you, as we finish up, Stan, first off, I want to thank you for your many years of service, your family sacrifice, the service you've done, especially during the pandemic. You and the Miss Crystal Group have shown great leadership and helping a lot of people navigate through this past year, and you've given people hope. What would you like to call on the average person listening today to do? What's their part in all this?
Yeah, it sort of depends on where are you age-wise. If you are younger than 28, I think you should be advocating with your parents, with your teachers, with everybody. You should be making clear that your generation is going to accept responsibility, whether they want to or not, and that you need the help getting prepared for that. And this kind of experience will do that. That can help overcome the inertia in older people. In older people, we've got to step up and say, all right, we are going to turn this nation over to generations behind us. We've got to give them an opportunity. We followed the greatest generation, and that greatest generation didn't choose to be it. They went through the Depression, World War II. They stood up and they did some great things. Not perfect, but some great things. We need to do the tough things that are going to set the nation up for the future. Unless we think that the America is in decline and we will just ride on the momentum we've got into the sunset, and I don't buy into that, then we've got to say, okay, what do we have to do to redouble our efforts right now? It's pretty obvious we got big things to fix, and the people who are going to fix them aren't you and me. It's going to be the young people behind us, and so we owe them the best prep, everything we can to make them cohesive as a generation, to make them educated, to make them inspired.
Yeah, I like that. We owe them, and I agree with you. And Stan, again, thank you. It's always a pleasure getting together with you, and I'm thankful that you've taken the time over the years to put some of this hard-earned wisdom into books and deliberations. We're all the better for it.
Well, I'd return the thanks to you, Jen. You helped make America a better place, and that's what we got to do.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much.